You must take charge of your destiny. If you don't, Bob will. For the A players, this could be a real opportunity. For the turkeys, I said, it will be marginal at best. Less than 20% liked what I had to say. The rest thought I ought to be arrested or committed. We looked long and hard for Larry Grossman's replacement. Michael Gartner came highly recommended by Tom Brokaw, the anchor of Nightly News and the dean of NBC. Michael had great news credentials. He had been the front page editor of the Wall Street Journal and editor of the Des Moines Register and the Louisville Courier Journal. Despite a somewhat quirky personality, he had a reputation for doing a top-notch job editorially and financially. He seemed the perfect fit, and in many ways he was. Gartner joined in July 1988. His first management change would end up leading to a great NBC success story. Tim Russert had been serving as Larry Grossman's deputy. Gartner wanted his own guy, so Bob Wright suggested that Russert get an operating job. Tim had been a staff assistant to Governor Mario Cuomo and Senator Pat Moynihan, so he'd never run anything. Michael offered him the job of bureau chief for NBC's Washington bureau. Tim resisted, worried about leaving the center of power in New York for an outpost. I spent an hour with him, describing why he should jump at the job to manage NBC News' biggest field operation. Here was the chance to show us what he could do as a manager. Tim's move to Washington was a win for everyone. He hired Katie Couric as a Washington correspondent in 1989. That was the start of what would be an incredible career. Katie became co-host of the Today Show in April 1991 and immediately caught on, establishing an easy rapport with the morning audience. The ratings began to climb. Katie has been the show's longest recognizable star. Sadly, Katie had a personal tragedy when her husband, Jay Monahan, died of colon cancer in 1998. All of America grieved with her. To increase awareness of colon cancer, she even went on national TV to have a colonoscopy, bringing attention to the procedure. During a recent physical, my doctor told me that as a result of Katie's efforts, he was booked for the next year. Meanwhile, Tim Russert's insights from Washington impressed Michael during the daily teleconferences with bureau chiefs for the Nightly News. In 1990, Michael put him on Meet the Press as a panelist. A year later, Tim replaced Garrick Utley as host of this show, and Garrick moved to New York with the Weekend Today Show. Tim has been special in so many ways. He's taken Meet the Press to first in the ratings, becoming arguably the leading political commentator on TV. His fame has not gone to his head. He's a straight shooter and extremely popular everywhere, particularly in GE. He'll go to any of our plants to give a talk and meet with employees. I wasn't sure Tim understood our stock option program when I got a notice that his 10-year-old grant was about to expire in 3 months. I called him and said, "You know, this piece of paper you have in your drawer is worth a lot of money and it runs out in 90 days. Jack, I've got faith," he said. Turned out he had more faith and more smarts than most of us and did very well by holding his options to the last days. Gartner didn't put just Tim into a position to succeed. He also was responsible for making Jeff Zucker the executive producer of the Today Show. Jeff had joined Dick Ebersol, the head of NBC Sports, straight out of Harvard as an assistant at the Seoul Olympics. Dick liked him, took him under his wing, and got him involved in the Today Show. With Ebersol's encouragement, Gartner and Bob decided to make Jeff, at age 26, executive producer of the Today Show. Their confidence was rewarded 1,000 times over with the tremendous success of the Today Show under Jeff's leadership. Jeff was named president of NBC's entertainment division in 2001. Now we need him to work his magic there. Everything wasn't perfect under Michael. His unfamiliarity with TV and his management style caused some issues. His courage to attack the NBC News cost structure, while popular with us, didn't win him support there. But Michael suffered his biggest blow when a major controversy broke out over a Dateline news feature. On November 17, 1992, Dateline ran a segment on allegations about the safety of General Motors pickup trucks. Waiting to Explode depicted GM trucks exploding on impact. On February 8, 1993, GM sued NBC, accusing the network of rigging the crash tests. An internal investigation found that some of the reported facts were suspect. Although Jane Pauley wasn't involved in the GM story, she agreed to go on Dateline and read an on-air apology that brought the issue to closure. That was the ultimate in being a team player. Jane was great to do that, and her well-earned credibility with the audience made a huge difference. Although Michael Gartner was not directly responsible, he never recovered from the Dateline incident. Before resigning on March 2nd, Michael was in the process of enticing Neil Shapiro from ABC to become executive producer of Dateline. Neil is creative, genuine in every way, and deservedly one of the most popular figures at NBC. He not only restored the show's credibility, he expanded Dateline into 3 to 4 primetime hours every week. The show became a huge success for NBC, and so did Neil. In 2001, he became president of NBC News. After the Dateline incident, Bob interviewed just about everybody in the news business to replace Gartner. Again, Tom Brokaw played a big role. Tom's reputation made him the public face of NBC News. He's been a mentor to many young news people over a 30-year career. Tireless and very demanding of himself, Tom has been a great help to Bob, who has used his counsel on almost every major decision at NBC News. After Bob interviewed all the obvious candidates, it was Tom who suggested that Bob talk to Andy Lack, then an executive producer at CBS. Andy and Bob had a long dinner at the Dorset Hotel, where Andy made a big impression. After this dinner, Bob wanted me to meet him, and I did a couple of days later. I think I've told everyone that Andy was the most exciting person I ever interviewed for a job. He was totally different from any of the news leaders I had met. He was humorous, spontaneous, filled with energy, and totally comfortable with himself. Traits by now, you know, I find appealing. He charmed the hell out of me. 20 minutes into the conversation, I turned to Bob and said, "What are we waiting for? Let's do it," Bob said. I looked at Andy and asked, "Why aren't you jumping up and down? This is a huge job we're offering you." He responded, "After all the stuff I heard about you guys, I'm wondering whether I'd get the resources to get news back on its feet." We both assured him he'd get what he needed to turn around the news operation. Andy called Bob on Sunday and took the job. He quit CBS on Monday morning and joined us in early April 1993. Meanwhile, Bob was moving ahead on cable. When we bought NBC, the network's only cable asset was a 1/3 financial interest in the Arts and Entertainment Channel. Bob was desperate to enter the cable business in a big way. The window was closing. In early 1987, he hired Tom Rogers, who had spent several years on the Hill working on telecommunications policy, as a congressional aide to Representative Tim Wirth. Bob put Tom in charge of expanding NBC's cable efforts. He had great contacts in the industry and was a terrific negotiator and a brilliant strategist. Tom and Bob went first to Chuck Dolan, a pioneer of the cable TV business. Chuck had founded Cablevision Systems in Long Island, a company that became one of the largest U.S. cable operators. Chuck launched Bravo, was co-founder of HBO, and had developed a group of other cable properties. Bob knew Chuck and his family and had almost left Cox in the early 1980s to become president of Cablevision. They struck a partnership in January 1989 with NBC buying half of Chuck's Rainbow properties for $140 million. The deal gave us interest in Bravo, American Movie Classics, Sports Channel USA, and regional sports services across the United States. NBC also would buy stakes in Court TV, the Independent Film Channel, the History Channel, and Romance Classics. Bob's deal with Chuck let either side bring to the partnership any new ideas we wanted to develop from scratch. The first big one was CNBC, the Business News Network. I loved the idea from the start. I thought there was an opportunity for a business channel, and unlike entertainment and sports, business programming wouldn't involve any rights fees. The only other competitor at the time was Financial News Network, FNN, and it was losing money. Chuck agreed to go into CNBC with us on a 50-50 basis, and CNBC went on the air in April 1989. By 1991, our cumulative losses were nearly $60 million. business news was not taking off. FNN went into bankruptcy in January. At that time, FNN had access to 32 million homes. CNBC had 20 million subscribers. Chuck had no interest in going after FNN in bankruptcy. He had had enough. Chuck withdrew his 50% ownership of CNBC, and we went after FNN alone. We thought we could get it for $50 million. We were all surprised when the opening bid from Westinghouse and Dow Jones was $60 million. The bidding reached $150 million when Bob and Tom Rogers came back and said they needed another $5 million. Silly as it now seems, the GE guys, including myself, agonized over our bid because it was 3 times our preliminary evaluation of the deal. Fortunately, we badly wanted a financial news network, and the extra $5 million closed the deal. The deal more than doubled our distribution. We retained the best FNN talent, including Ron Insana and Sue Herrera, who today co-anchor our top-rated Business Center news program, and Bill Griffith, who hosts Power Lunch. On the entertainment side, things weren't going as well. From 1988 to 1992, we introduced dozens of shows that didn't click. I wasn't worth a nickel here. After acquiring NBC, I went to Hollywood once to look at the pilots for the new primetime schedule. You ought to hear the presentations and the wild predictions of success for each pilot. Every show has a shot. A great producer, sensational stars, an Emmy winning this or that. Every comedy is Seinfeld reincarnated, and every drama is ER. Thank God there are so many optimists in the business. Facts are, I've never seen anyone predict a sure thing. Most of the shows bomb. Something like 1 in 10 that come out of development make it on the air, and you're lucky if 1 in 5 of these are successful. The odds of getting a series that really clicks, like Seinfeld, Frasier, or Friends, is something like 1 in 1,000. People would always say to me, "How can you own NBC? You don't know anything about dramas or comedies." That's true, but I can't build a jet engine or a turbine either. My job at GE was to deal with resources, people, and dollars. I offered as much or as little help to our aircraft engine design engineers as I offered to the people picking shows in Hollywood. We weren't doing too well out there. Most of the past NBC hits had run out of gas. Brandon Tartikoff left NBC to run Paramount in 1991. Bob named Brandon's deputy, Warren Littlefield, as president of entertainment. Warren inherited a difficult situation. We didn't have any new shows, and the TV advertising market fell into its worst slump in 2 decades. NBC's profits fell from a peak of $603 million in 1989 to $204 million in 1992. That year, we had to make a difficult decision. We were in Boca in 1992 at the time of the decision on who should take over The Tonight Show from Johnny Carson. This was a terrible dilemma because both Jay Leno and David Letterman were on our network at the time. Close to midnight, CFO Dennis Dammerman and I walked into a conference room in the middle of a hot discussion. Most of the East Coast guys wanted Letterman. The West Coast guys, hooked up by video conference, favored Leno. Bob wanted to keep both of them. He feared that picking one would risk a defection by the other to CBS, which had nothing going for it on a late night. Dennis and I sat in the back of the room, listening to the debate, when Bob turned to us. "What do you guys think?" "You know, I'm not qualified to pick either one," I said, "but if I were you, I would do this. I'd go for GE values. You like Leno's values. He's good for the affiliates. He's a good human being. The American public will find out that's true." We got beat up over the Leno decision. Letterman left us for CBS and pulled ahead in the early going. The critics were everywhere, and they were joined by Grant Tinker. I liked Grant and thought I had a good relationship with him. In 1994, he came out with a book that blamed Bob and me for the decline. He called my decision to appoint Bob head of the network a kamikaze assignment. He said our decision to replace Johnny Carson with Jay Leno was dead wrong. He claimed we overpaid for FNN, and he placed CNBC in the dead air category. Other than its stock ticker, CNBC has failed to develop any discernible persona, wrote Tinker in his book. I wondered whether Jack ever watches it and what he thinks of it. The venom in Grant's comments surprised me until I noticed that his book was co-authored by Bud Ruckeiser. Bud was a former public relations head of NBC who had left on less than amicable terms in the spring of 1988. In the middle of the slump, we added to our problems. We partnered with Chuck Dolan to do a cable triple cast of the 1992 Summer Olympics in Barcelona. For an extra $125, cable subscribers could have three channels to watch over 1,000 hours of live and taped coverage without commercials. It was a flop. We had hoped to sign up as many as 3 million of the 40 million homes that could receive the offer. Instead, we drew about 250,000 viewers. We took a real beating in the media and financially. We were looking at a $100 million loss on the triple cast alone. While Bob was confident Chuck would honor his commitments, our accountants worried that we'd get stuck for the majority of it, even though Dolan was our 50-50 partner. Chuck is as tough a negotiator as they come. He is also as honorable a guy as you'll meet. In November, we received a check from him for $50 million to cover his share of the Triplecast losses. Triplecast was just another problem in a troubled time. From 1992 until 1994, we spent a lot of time struggling with all these issues and were searching for a solution. That led to talks with lots of players, including Paramount, Disney, Time Warner, Viacom, and Sony. We weren't looking for cash. We were trying to put things together to make NBC a bigger and stronger player. We came closest with Disney and Paramount. Dennis Dammerman, our advisors, and I had a dinner meeting with Disney CEO Michael Eisner and a team from Disney one evening during the summer of 1994. We came to a tentative understanding that Disney would buy 49% of NBC, but would have operating control while we retained majority ownership. My main condition was that Bob Wright would be the CEO of the combined Disney TV production studios and NBC's operations. Michael liked it, and Dennis and I were thrilled. By morning, though, Michael had changed his mind and didn't want to do the deal. We had several other serious discussions, including some with Marty Davis of Paramount, that ended up the same way. With all these discussions going on, the press naturally got hold of it. Speculation about GE's plans for NBC ran rampant throughout 1994. Bob Nelson, Dennis, and I prepared an analysis on why we thought staying in the network business made sense long term. The value of the property at the time was somewhere in the $4 billion to $5 billion range. We were confident we could create a far more valuable asset with very limited downside. I took the analysis to the board in October 1994, recommending that we stay in the business. It was the only time I ever polled every board member, one by one, for a show of support for a decision. They agreed unanimously to stick with NBC, and we went public with our commitment to the network. Meanwhile, Warren Littlefield was having success developing new shows. Bob decided to give Warren more support and hired as head of West Coast operations Don Ohlmeyer, the old friend who had tipped me off to Tartikoff's itchiness. Warren and Don were a perfect match. Warren was deep into the programming details. Don, a blunt and irreverent 6'3" bear of a guy, had a knack for promotion. He was running his own successful production company, and we actually bought it to get him. His larger-than-life presence helped bring back a sense of pride to our Burbank studios. Seinfeld and Mad About You, two shows begun under the earlier administration, were already catching on. Within 18 months of their collaboration under Don's leadership, the two of them launched Frasier, Friends, and ER. A turnaround was underway. News was also enjoying success under Andy Lack. When he arrived in April 1993, we were a distant 3 out of 3. None of our news programs was number one, Today, Nightly News, or Dateline. There were even suggestions that we give back the second hour of the Today Show to our affiliates because the show's ratings were so weak. Within 2 months of joining us as president of news, Andy was pitching at a business review what some of his colleagues believed was a crazy idea. He wanted to move the Today Show out of its old third-floor studio in the GE building and build a new studio at street level in Rockefeller Center. He thought this could really change the game. We could use Katie Couric and Brian Gumbel in ways to get some buzz and engage the audience, said Andy. This is not a cheap idea. It'll cost $15 million. If it bombs, it'll be a big bomb. No, 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 I shouted. It's not going to bomb. It's a great idea. Let's do it. Dennis, I said, you can find $15 million. After moving into the new studio 18 months later in the fall of 1994, Today began to take off. The massive windows that allowed people to peer into the studio and the opportunity to take the show into Rock Center made Today a New York City tourist attraction. On Friday mornings, Today's live outdoor concerts in the plaza often attract thousands of people. On the other hand, Brian Gumbel, after 15 years with the Today Show, was getting tired of the morning drill. He and his agent made it clear to Andy that they wanted to try something new. Andy and Bob started thinking about replacements. A solution was in our backyard. Bill Bolster, the president of WNBC, NBC's New York station, had been facing the challenge of fixing the 5-7 morning show that preceded the Today Show. He had watched Matt Lauer a few years earlier hosting an interview on Channel 9 in New York. Since then, Matt's career had been going nowhere. In fact, one morning, Matt spotted a help wanted sign on the back of a truck of a tree trimming firm. He called and left a message for the job. When Bill Bolster telephoned the next day, Matt thought the call was from the landscaper. Instead, it was Bolster with a better offer, a much better offer. He hired Matt to co-anchor WNBC's early morning news. Shortly after joining the station in late 1992, I watched him at 6:30 a.m. on WNBC after starting the morning on the treadmill with CNBC. Like Bill, I thought Matt filled the screen. He was unassuming yet charismatic, and he looked like a potential replacement for Brian. Within a year, my campaign began. I'd call Andy endlessly, acting as Matt's best agent. Bolster had an ally. "What do you think of Matt Lauer?" "He's great," Andy said. "When are you going to give him the job?" "He needs a little more seasoning." "Oh, come on, let's go." Today's executive producer, Jeff Zucker, tried Matt out as a newsreader in 1994, and gradually Matt began subbing when Bryant was out on vacation. Everyone liked his style. CBS took Bryant out of the morning business with a great offer for his own primetime show. We were all happy for Bryant. Matt took over for him in early 1997. Katie Couric and Matt turned out to be a great match, instantly captivating the morning audience. Today, which became the number one morning show in 1996, widened the gap between itself and number two, ABC's Good Morning America. The following year, Tom Brokaw made Nightly News number one, a position it still holds. Dateline executive producer Neil Shapiro, with co-anchors Jane Pauley and Stone Phillips, turned around our primetime magazine show after the GM debacle. Andy really had things working at NBC News. The person who got CNBC going was Roger Ailes, a former political advisor to President George Bush and executive producer of Rush Limbaugh's TV show. Bob found Roger and hired him as CEO of CNBC in August 1993. I was an instant fan. Roger was a edgy and excitable guy, full of opinions. He created a distinctive look for CNBC, plotted its primetime programming, and promoted personalities like Chris Matthews. Chris brings energy to the coverage of Washington mishaps. Roger also created from scratch a talking heads network called America's Talking. He built CNBC's operating profits from $9 million in 1993 to $50 million in 1995. The creation of MSNBC, our joint venture with Microsoft, indirectly drove Roger out of the company. He didn't like our decision to fold his baby, America's Talking, into MSNBC. I hated losing Roger when he left in January 1996 to start up Fox News Channel, which he has made into a real success. We replaced Roger with Bill Bolster, who had built WNBC to a number one position in New York. Bill put on the CNBC screen a real-time ticker for stock market prices and treated our business coverage as a fast-paced sports event. He expanded the pregame show for the stock market with a three-hour block of Squawk Box. Squawk Box has developed an ensemble of characters, Mark Haynes, Joe Kernan, and David Faber. Their spontaneous banter and sharp insights rev up the market before it opens. The show's popularity has just about every CEO in America watching. The game is reported, often from the field or trading floor, by CNBC's first real celebrity, Maria Bartiromo, whose inside scoops earned her the reputation of being one of the best financial journalists in the country. The post-game show, Business Center, hosted by Ron Insana and Sue Herrera, is like ESPN's Sports Center. They've made it the most authoritative financial news program on television. As he was shaping the day's programming, I pestered Bill constantly. I sent him clips of the same business stories out of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post, urging him to adopt the Post's more blunt and entertaining approach. After all, business is a game. Bill and his team, led by Bruno Cohen, former news director at NBC TV in New York, have in fact captured the sport of it. CNBC's profits over the next 5 years rose to $290 million in 2000, making it one of the most profitable assets in cable television. By 1996, NBC had turned around. Operating profits surpassed $1 billion for the first time. ER had become the number one drama series on TV. Seinfeld was the number one sitcom. CNBC was profitable and growing rapidly. America agreed that Jay Leno was the best late-night host, as The Tonight Show won the late-night battle with CBS's David Letterman. Late in 1995, Bob Wright, aware that Microsoft was thinking of making an investment in CNN, started discussions with them about a possible tie-up. We had always wanted to develop a cable news channel, but it was very expensive to do from scratch. At an NBC strategy review session in October 1995, Bob described his ongoing negotiations with Microsoft. We were having trouble figuring out the right relationship with Microsoft. One possibility was a licensing arrangement. I jumped up and went to an easel and led a discussion of all the alternatives, eventually drawing on a flip chart, a partnership structure similar to that of many previous GE deals. In this structure, we'd have a couple of 50-50 joint ventures, one on the cable side with NBC in control, and another on the internet side with Microsoft in control. Tom Rogers and Bob then began negotiating this concept with the Microsoft team. Microsoft was primarily interested in using our news-gathering operation and developing an online news channel. Cable was secondary, which made the negotiations more difficult. The evening before a December 1995 press conference to announce the partnership, there were still a number of sticking points. Tom and his team had been up all night trying to close the deal. Bill Gates' concern about cable was the last open issue. By 7 a.m., just 2 hours before a major press conference at NBC's New York studios, the deal still wasn't done. The announcement was scheduled to be a grand affair, with Bill hooked up by satellite from Hong Kong and Tom Brokaw in Germany. To close the deal, Bob Wright asked me to intervene with Gates. I called him. Bill was concerned that he could get stuck with major losses in cable. "Jack," Bill asked, "do you believe the cable forecasts?" "I think cable's a no-brainer," I replied. "You're the guy who has the tough job with the online part. I don't have any doubt we'll make cable work." I gave Bill some guarantees on cable performance to protect Microsoft from major losses if we couldn't get the channel into more homes. "That's enough for me," he replied. About 40 minutes before the press conference, Bill Gates and I agreed. MSNBC turned into the black in 2000, and MSN became the number one news internet site. MSNBC also gave NBC the chance to showcase Brian Williams. Brian had joined the network in 1993 and was backing up Tom Brokaw on nightly news and doing weekend anchoring. Andy Lack gave him his own show, The News with Brian Williams. While you don't see it much on the air, Brian can be one of the funniest guys you'd ever meet. I actually think he's so talented that if he wasn't already committed as a news anchor, he could have his own late-night show. Bob and Tom Rogers continued looking for internet opportunities and made a number of dot-com investments, later merging most of them into a new public company called NBCI. Like so many other dot-coms at the time, NBCI focused too much on advertising revenues. When the internet ad market fell apart in early 2000, its business model couldn't make it. In 2001, we repurchased NBCI and began using it as a portal to promote the rest of NBC. Toward the end of 1997, Bob and I got some bad news. Jerry Seinfeld, star of television's hottest primetime sitcom, wanted to call it quits. Jerry wasn't only America's favorite comic, he was also mine. At a Sunday brunch in Bob's New York apartment in December 1997, we tried to convince Jerry to stay on the air for one more season. A year earlier, we had gone through the same drill and convinced Seinfeld to stay on through the 1997 season. That time, Bob called me down to his office to see if I could help make the sale. It was a quirky meeting. To convince Jerry to stay, we had given him a package of stock options and restricted stock. Jerry asked me to take him through what they meant. It was a priceless moment as I pretended to give a finance lesson to someone who could play dumb as a fox as well as he could get a good laugh. We talked him into returning then. Now he wanted out again, before the 1998 season. This time, Jerry brought along two wonderful friends, George Shapiro and Howard West, who could have come out of central casting as old-time Hollywood agents. Bob made a great presentation, a typical GE pitch with charts, to show that Jerry would be the only television star who left while his series was still growing. No show in the history of TV, not even Milton Berle's, was growing its audience in its ninth year. Jerry wanted to go out on top. Bob argued that Jerry hadn't even seen the peak. It was a great pitch, and we offered Jerry $100 million in GE stock to stay just one more year. Bob and I thought we had made the sale. That feeling lasted about 10 days. On Christmas Eve, I got a phone call in Florida from Jerry in Burbank. "Jack," he said, "this is a very hard decision for me, and I hate to disappoint you." I felt awful. I knew we had lost him. "Jack, it's Christmas Eve, and I'm in my cubicle. Everyone else has gone off to their families, and I'm here writing a show. I can't do it another year, Jack. I can't." "I wish you'd made a different decision," I said. I thanked him for all that he had done for us. I respected his choice. He wanted to go out on top, and he did. We not only lost Jerry, we also lost the NFL. After televising pro football since 1965, we lost the broadcast rights to the National Football League in early 1998. Passing on this was an easy decision. There was no one at NBC, even in sports, who wanted to touch the numbers needed to get the rights. Of course, my favorite paper, the New York Post, always has great fun with things like this. They put a mugshot on the front page showing me dropping the ball. Yet this wasn't a fumble. We passed on that $4 billion 8-year deal because the numbers were nuts. Losing the NFL led to our efforts to launch in 2001 a new football league, the XFL, for Extreme Football, with Vince McMahon, head of the World Wrestling Federation. It turned out to be a bomb, and I was right in the middle of it. If you screw up in another business, you can generally hide it, but not on TV. Everybody's always watching, especially the critics. I was as big a supporter of the XFL as anyone in the company. We had nothing going on Saturday nights. Vince McMahon had flair and made a big success with the WWF. Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura added drama as an announcer. We launched the new league with 8 teams and some key markets. Our problem was we could never decide whether the XFL was entertainment or football. The dilemma began when they bought the Vegas bookies to the training camps. The bookies didn't want the crazy rules the XFL had proposed because that made it more difficult to put odds on the games. Our sports division thought we needed the credibility and publicity the betting lines would provide. That closed the door to doing some things that might have made the XFL far more entertaining. The first game got off to a big rating start, but even then we lost audience during the long game. The sports writers tore us apart. The only coverage the league got was opinion pieces on how the XFL threatened the sanctity of professional football. The fans didn't like either the entertainment or the football. The death watch began. Nobody watched the games. Everyone watched our failure. After a single 12-week season, we called it quits. The XFL turned out to be a rock. It cost us $60 million, the equivalent of a couple of failed sitcoms, and 8 out of 10 of those don't make it. While it wasn't pleasant, it wasn't a large financial hit. Taking those swings is one of the big benefits of GE size. You don't have to connect all the time. Although the XFL failed, almost everything else Dick Ebersol was involved with was a success. Dick, who joined in early 1989, was the protege of Rune Arledge, the pioneer of Monday Night Football and Olympics coverage. Dick succeeded Rune as the master of televised sports. In 1995, Dick pulled off the ultimate coup in sports programming. For the first time in 20 years, the International Olympics Committee agreed to give NBC broadcast rights without competitive bidding. NBC laid the groundwork for Dick's agreement, televising the Summer Olympics in Seoul in 1988, Barcelona in 1992, and Atlanta in 1996. Toward the end of July 1995, Bob and Dick called me with a novel proposal. Dick and his team wanted to make an unprecedented offer to the Olympics Committee to acquire both the 2000 Sydney and the 2002 Salt Lake City Olympics. By going for two games instead of one, Dick believed, they could get both games and eliminate the usual bidding process. They wanted to move quickly. To get approval, Dick arranged a conference call with Bob on a boat off the Nantucket coast, while Dennis Dammerman joined us from a cabin in Maine, and I participated from my summer house in Nantucket. The price was steep, $1.2 billion. "Dick, what's the worst-case scenario here?" I asked. "We could lose $100 million," he replied. We all agreed to go for it. Dick immediately took the GE jet to Sweden to meet with Juan Antonio Samaranch, president of the International Olympics Committee, and then flew to Montreal to meet with Dick Pound, the committee's head of TV rights. Within 72 hours, he had locked up both Olympics. A few days later, Dick was thinking about doing more. By early December 1995, 4 months later, we had gained the rights to broadcast three more Olympics in Athens, in Torino, and for the 2008 Games for $2.3 billion. The Olympics deal has been a home run for both the network and particularly its cable properties. Carrying the Olympics on our two major cable properties allowed David Zaslav, head of cable distribution, to significantly expand the duration of the carriage and the reach of CNBC and MSNBC into millions of homes. Today, CNBC has commitments to be in over 80 million homes, and MSNBC, which had fewer than 25 million subs in 1995, will be in over 70 million homes in 2002. Over the years, NBC has proved an enormous benefit to GE. We've profited from its financial results and from the glitter that makes most employees proud to wear a T-shirt with the NBC logo. Bob's vision to CNBC as more than just a network was a winner. The network audience has continued to erode, making his bets on cable television look even better. CNBC is the leader in financial news, and MSNBC is the top-rated cable news network on a 24-hour basis among 25 to 54-year-old viewers. Even though NBC has fallen to third place in household ratings as I'm writing this book, it's still the leading network among people 18 to 49, the most important demographic group for advertisers. Through it all, Bob Wright has become one of the longest-serving network heads in TV history. He has proved that a light bulb maker can make it big in the TV business. Chapter 18, When to Fight, When to Fold. One of my strongest childhood memories is of climbing the stairs to my parents' second-floor flat in Salem, Massachusetts, and hearing my mother crying. I was only 9 years old in 1945. I had never heard my mother cry before. When I walked through the doorway, she was standing over an ironing board in the kitchen, pressing my father's shirts. Tears were streaming down her face. "Oh, God," she said, "Franklin Roosevelt has died." I was stunned. I didn't know why the president's death would cause my mother such heartache. I didn't understand it at all. Yet I felt some of the same feelings when John Kennedy was assassinated 18 years later and I was glued to the TV set. My mother's reaction to Roosevelt's death came from her heartfelt belief that he had saved our country and our democracy. She put her faith in him and our government. So did my father. Both of them believed that the government served the will of the people, protected its citizens, and always did what was right. For many years, I shared my parents' faith, but that faith has been severely tested on a number of occasions. I've seen government up close, both right and wrong, both good and almost evil, from honest, hard-working public servants to politically motivated, devious self-promoters. I'd seen many small instances of bad government in action, but my first big case didn't come until 1992. I was in the middle of a board meeting in Florence, South Carolina, when our general counsel, Ben Heineman, pulled me aside. He said that the Wall Street Journal was doing a story for the next day, April 22nd, on a lawsuit filed by Ed Russell, a vice president who had been fired in November. This was no ordinary suit for wrongful discharge. Russell, who had run our industrial diamonds business in Ohio, accused us of conspiring with De Beers of South Africa to fix diamond prices. He claimed that he was fired because he complained about a meeting his boss, Glenn Heiner, had with De Beers to supposedly fix these prices. I left the board meeting that afternoon and huddled with Ben and Joyce Hergenhan, our vice president of public relations. I knew Russell wasn't telling the truth. For one thing, Glenn Heiner, head of GE Plastics, had impeccable integrity. For another, Russell had been fired for performance reasons. I knew, because at one crucial point, I had written his direct boss, telling him Russell had to go, something that even Russell didn't know. I had met him shortly after he joined GE in 1974 as a strategic planner. He moved up through our lighting business and in 1985 became general manager of GE Super Abrasives, the name of our industrial diamond business. I knew that business well because I oversaw it from Pittsfield in the early 1970s. At first, Russell did well on the job, increasing revenues and profits nicely. But in 1990, he hit a wall. Profits dropped to $57 million from $70 million the year before. Over the course of 1991, Russell's problems continued. His numbers didn't improve, and he had difficulty explaining the situation in a series of reviews with his boss, Glenn Heiner, the head of our plastics business. I was troubled by it. I had been a supporter of Russell's for many years and approved his promotion to general manager of Super Abrasives in the first place. However, in September, Heiner and I had what would be our last review with Russell in Pittsfield. He was totally unable to answer my questions. At one point, he said he wasn't prepared to discuss some straightforward issues in his business because he didn't think that was the purpose of the meeting. My financial analyst, Bob Nelson, was in the session with me and felt as surprised as I was by Russell's response. The next day, I scribbled a note to Glenn Heiner summarizing the meeting. In it, I included the observation that Russell made a fool of himself in July, and yesterday he appeared totally out of it. Bottom line, Russell has to go. The next month, Heiner called him back to Pittsfield and on November 11th fired him. Now, Russell had filed a lawsuit making all kinds of crazy claims, accusing Heiner of wrongdoing. Before drafting a response to it, I remembered the note I had sent Heiner and had it faxed to me in Florence. Luckily, my note made clear that Russell was fired for performance reasons and that I did it, not Heiner, who was the target of Russell's made-up charges. Ben, Joyce, and I drafted a statement for the Journal and other reporters. We made it clear that Russell was removed for performance shortcomings and that he had many conversations with GE people trying to get a better severance package. Russell never brought up any antitrust issues in those talks. He was a bitter employee who had been canned. The next day's stories contained even worse news. Russell had gotten the Justice Department to open a criminal investigation into his price-fixing allegations. When a Journal reporter asked me about it after the meeting, I called it pure nonsense. We began our own investigation. We called in lawyers from Arnold & Porter and Dan Webb, a litigator with Winston & Strawn, to look into the charges. It didn't take much longer than 6 weeks for the outside lawyers to conclude that Russell wasn't telling the truth. Now we had to convince the Justice Department. We shared with them the results of the investigation and put together a white paper that documented 12 outright misrepresentations Russell had told in his depositions in the case. It fell on deaf ears. In February 1994, Ben Heineman and I went to Washington to meet with an assistant attorney general to make our case. She couldn't have cared less about our arguments. She was out to get an indictment, and nothing was going to get in her way. To avoid an indictment for price fixing, she asked us to plead guilty to a felony and pay a fine. There was no way I was going to do that. We hadn't done anything wrong. The government's case was built on a bunch of lies. We had to fight this all the way. A grand jury indictment is usually routine when the government requests it. 3 days after our meeting in Washington, she got her indictment against us and De Beers for allegedly conspiring to fix prices. She didn't trust her own lieutenants, so she hired an outside lawyer at the government's expense. 8 months later, on October 25th, the trial started in a federal court in Columbus, Ohio. Dan Webb led the litigation team with great support from Bill Baer of Arnold & Porter and Jeff Kindler, GE's inside litigation chief. The team did such a good job destroying the government's case that we never had to present our evidence. On December 5th, after listening to all the government's evidence, Judge George Smith threw out the entire case. The government's conspiracy theory falls apart completely, he said. The government's arguments are without merit. Even when the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the government, no rational trier of fact could find GE guilty. The clear victory in the Russell case justified fighting for what we knew was right. The government had no case, just a knee-jerk dislike of a big company. Judges almost never dismiss a criminal antitrust case in the middle of a trial, before a defendant has even presented its side. But that's what happened here. The fight took us 3 years. 3 years of bad press every time it was mentioned. Only the facts told us we were right. This was government at its worst. They got the FBI to wire a dismissed employee and got nothing. They spent a great amount of time chasing nothing. They hired an expensive outside gun to try the case, all so some government types could make names for themselves. Of course, we're not perfect. In a completely different case a year earlier, the government had been right. This one started with Ben as well, when he called me on a Saturday afternoon at home in December 1990. "You're not going to believe this," he said, "but we have an employee who has a joint Swiss bank account with an Israeli Air Force general." I couldn't believe my ears. If there was one thing I preached every day at GE, it was integrity. It was our number one value. Nothing came before it. We never had a corporate meeting where I didn't emphasize integrity in my closing remarks. When Ben called me at home that Saturday, we knew only what had been reported in the Israeli newspapers and picked up by a GE employee over there. The press reported that an employee of our aircraft engine business, Herbert Steindler, had conspired with Air Force General Rami Dotan in a scheme to divert money from major contracts to supply GE engines for Israeli F-16 warplanes. By the time this mess was over, 19 months and many headlines later, we had to discipline 21 GE executives, managers, and employees, pay the U.S. government $69 million in criminal fines and civil penalties, and testify before a congressional committee. The head of our aircraft engine business had to stand up in federal court to plead guilty for the company, and a GE vice chairman spent a week in Washington getting our engine business off suspension. I nearly choked when I heard Ben's news. Imagine having a crook on your payroll. Steindler was suspended immediately, and when he refused to cooperate with our internal investigation, he was fired in March. We hired a group of outside lawyers from Wilmer, Cutler, and Pickering to help a GE audit team do an investigation. For most of the next year, they virtually lived in Cincinnati, the home of our aircraft engine business. Working with our audit staff, they traced every process of the contracts and talked to every participant. Over a 9-month period, they reviewed 350,000 pages of documents and interviewed more than 100 witnesses. It turned out that Dotan, with Steindler's help, had set up a fake New Jersey subcontractor. A close friend of Steindler's owned the firm, and they used it to divert about $11 million to the joint Swiss bank accounts owned by Dotan and Steindler. Dotan was a demanding and intimidating customer. As early as 1987, some employees began raising questions about certain aspects of Dotan's transactions. But the Air Force general portrayed himself as a great patriot in Israel who was simply cutting through red tape, and Steinler convinced his superiors there was nothing to be concerned about. Only one employee knowingly violated our policies for direct financial gain, Steinler. Throwing him overboard was easy. The problem was that 20 other GE employees who didn't gain a cent were not sensitive to the scheme. Those 20 people had worked for GE for a total of 325 years. Some of them had been employees their entire professional lives, as long as 37 years. Many had impressive track records and superb performance reviews. Two of them were corporate officers and good friends of Brian Rose, head of our aircraft engine business. Brian was a larger-than-life figure in the aircraft industry, a pioneer who still enjoyed designing engines. Brian loved his guys. He was having a difficult time deciding what to do with them. Brian's indecision was understandable. With the exception of Steinler, who ended up going to jail, most of the other people caught up in this were guilty of omission, not commission. None of them benefited personally from the scheme. They were outsmarted or just sloppy, or they ignored warning signals. Beyond Steinler, everyone else's involvement was less clear. That made the disciplinary case very difficult for everyone, but especially so for Brian. The only good thing that came out of it was that I found Bill Connedy. Bill, who would later become head of human resources for all of GE, had just taken over the HR job at Aircraft Engines. He bore the brunt of the disciplinary action, making sure that everyone was treated as fairly as possible under the circumstances. All the employees caught up in this mess received detailed letters outlining our concerns or allegations based on our internal investigation. They had the opportunity to give their side of the story with the help of lawyers they hired at our expense. Bill came back with disciplinary recommendations for each employee. At one point during a 2-month period, Bill, Brian, Ben, and I were on the phone nearly every day. Frankly, it was easier for Ben and me sitting in Fairfield to be tough disciplinarians than for poor Brian, whose longtime friends were involved. Fortunately, all three of us had great respect for Bill, and he was able to bridge any differences that existed among us. Ultimately, we fired or asked for the resignations of 11 of the 21 people involved. 6 other employees were demoted, and the remaining 4 were reprimanded. One officer had to be demoted, and the other one resigned. It sent a clear message through the company. Sergeants weren't going to be shot while generals and colonels could continue on as if nothing happened. We wanted our managers to know that if an integrity violation occurred on their watch, it was their responsibility. That chiefs got shot for being indifferent to integrity was a huge event in GE. In many ways, it was a big learning experience for me, both internally in terms of discipline and externally with Washington and the media. Outside GE, the idea began to surface that it was the pressure of competition and the drive for profits that made people cheat. Some didn't want to see it for what it was, an isolated violation in a company with hotlines, ombudsmen, voluntary disclosure policies, and constant leadership emphasis on integrity. I went to Washington in July 1992 to testify before a House subcommittee chaired by U.S. Representative John Dingell. I found Dingell tough, but honest and fair. It was all I could ask for. We had settled with the Justice Department, agreeing to pay $69 million a week before my appearance on the Hill. Testifying was not the most pleasant thing I ever did, but I felt strongly about my message, and I wanted to deliver it in person. I told the committee, "Excellence and competitiveness aren't incompatible with honesty and integrity." I added, "Mr. Chairman, we have an employee population that would rank with St. Paul or Tampa if it were an American city. We have no police force, no jails. We must rely on the integrity of our people as our first defense. Unfortunately, that system wasn't good enough in this case. But I take great pride that 99.99% of our 275,000 people get up every morning all over the world and compete like hell with absolute integrity. They don't need a policeman or a judge. They only need their conscience as they face the mirror each morning. They see no conflict between taking on the world's best every day all over the globe, giving 110% and more to compete and win and grow, and at the same time maintaining an instinctive, unbendable commitment to absolute integrity in everything we do. I got a fair hearing that day. Despite the ugliness of why I was there, I felt very good about making the point, and I feel even more strongly today that integrity must be the foundation for competitiveness. One of the most frustrating issues I've had to deal with for 25 years, 20 as CEO, was PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls. PCBs, a liquid chemical, were used prior to 1977 as an insulating fluid for electrical products to prevent fires. They became the focal point of a massive Hudson River dredging proposal by the Environmental Protection Agency in December 2000. The agency came up with this plan in the final days of the Clinton administration. It's really a case where good science and common sense have become drowned out by loud voices and extreme views to prod the government to punish a large global corporation. Over the years, this debate has gone from PCBs to a more fundamental crusade. Extremists have latched onto issues like PCBs to challenge the basic role of the corporation. These people often see companies as inanimate objects, incapable of values and feelings. GE isn't made up of bricks and buildings. It's nothing more than the flesh and blood of the people who make it come alive. It's made up of people who live in the same communities, whose children go to the same schools as the critics. They have the same hopes and dreams, the same hurts and pains. Corporations are human. When they're big, they're an easy target. And when they're winners, they're an even bigger target. Facts are, GE has one of the best environmental and safety records of any company in the world. It has more than 300 manufacturing and assembly locations and virtually no disputes with governments over compliance issues. Nearly 60 facilities in the United States have been given special star recognition by federal regulators for health and safety compliance. In the last decade, we've reduced emissions of 17 ozone-depleting chemicals by more than 90%, and our total emissions, which the EPA measures, by over 60%. This didn't happen by accident. All our plant managers go through rigorous training programs and report annually on their performance to their business CEOs and a VP for environmental programs. Every 3 months, I get an update on each business's environmental and safety performance. In short, we've approached the environment and worker safety the way we did everything else. We set the bar high, we measure, and we expect outstanding results. We're not perfect, nobody is, but we were always striving to be the best. Money is never the issue. GE has the resources to do the right thing, and we know that doing the right thing is always better for our bottom line over the long run. Only in this context can you appreciate why we've been so adamant about the PCB issue? For me, the PCB story started accidentally a couple of weeks before Christmas 1975, when I was a group executive in Pittsfield. I was visiting a semiconductor plant in Syracuse one day when the division manager happened to mention casually that New York's Department of Environmental Conservation, DEC, was going to hold a hearing soon. He said it would focus on a possible violation by two of his capacitor plants in upstate New York that were discharging PCBs into the Hudson River. I had never dealt with PCBs before, but being a chemical engineer, I was familiar with plant discharges, and I was curious about this hearing. A couple of days later, I was in my Pittsfield office and had a slow day. I decided to drive over the mountain to Albany to find out what was going on. I sat in the back of the hearing room and no one knew I was there. That day, GE's expert witness was testifying. A biologist and vice president of a laboratory hired by us, he claimed his tests showed negligible levels of PCBs in fish from the Hudson. Our expert didn't look or sound like one. He seemed unsure of his own work. He had trouble giving a straight answer. The more I listened, the more uncomfortable I got. I knew if he couldn't convince me, he couldn't convince the hearing officer. After the hearing, I called Art Puccini, my general counsel, and asked him to come over from Pittsfield. This now seemed important enough that I should stay overnight. Art and I asked the GE expert to come to my motel room. We asked him to walk us through all the details of his handwritten control sheets for the study. After questioning him until 2:30 a.m., we were convinced that he hadn't done a thorough job. We felt we could not use his data or allow the hearing officer to use it either. I could have strangled him. The next day, I told our outside defense lawyers not to rely on his data and to tell the hearing officer the same thing. 2 months later, the DEC hearing officer issued an interim ruling that, in his words, claimed PCB contamination was a result of both corporate abuse and regulatory failure because our PCB usage had been legal and we had state permits to discharge them. Now I was into it. Art and I negotiated a settlement with DEC Commissioner Peter Burrell, who later became president of the National Audubon Society. The DEC hearing officer, a Columbia University law professor named Abe Sofair, helped to mediate the settlement. We agreed to pay $3.5 million to a river cleanup fund, support research on PCBs, and stop using the chemical. New York's DEC agreed to match our contribution and release us from any further liability on the Hudson. Burrell and I eventually signed the settlement. The New York Times ran a picture of both of us above the headline, GE State Pact on PCB is praised as guide in other pollution cases. The Times quoted Sofair, who called the settlement an effective precedent for dealing with situations of joint culpability. Governor Hugh Carey later offered to drink a glass of water from the Hudson River to demonstrate his confidence that the river water was not harmful. The September 8, 1976 agreement even required the state to turn to the federal government for money if any further action to protect public health and resources were needed. That's as clear as can be on page 3 of the agreement. In the event that the funds herein provided for implementing remedial action concerning PCBs present in the Hudson River shall be inadequate to assure protection of public health and resources, then the department will use its best efforts to obtain additional funds from sources other than General Electric that are necessary to assure such protection. These best efforts will include preparation by the department of a plan of action to obtain such funds, including specifying applications will be made to federal agencies and/or other sources of funds in as expeditious a manner as possible. But it didn't end there. The settlement had been made on the basis of animal studies. I wanted to know if PCBs caused cancer in humans and whether our workers were at risk. I knew that if a company-funded study was going to have any credibility, I had to get the most widely respected scientist I could find. So I went down to see Dr. Erwin Selikoff, then head of Mount Sinai's Environmental School of Medicine. Selikoff had become something of an environmental icon after finding that exposure to asbestos could cause lung cancer. He listened carefully to my request. I asked him if he would go to our plants to study GE employees who had the greatest exposure to PCBs. For years, those employees had worked in it up to their elbows. I gave Selikoff total access to our employees. He put a research team together and set up a lab at our Fort Edward plant. Selikoff first examined over 300 volunteers from the two GE factories. His study, finally published in 1982, is what convinced me more than anything else that PCBs didn't cause cancer. Selikoff's mortality study found there were no cancer deaths or other serious side effects among workers 30 years after they were first exposed. Normally, in a population of the size he studied, without any major PCB exposure, at least 8 cancer deaths would have been expected. Other scientists studied utility workers and Westinghouse employees who had been heavily exposed to PCBs. Alexander Smith of the government's National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health gave the most succinct summary of this work in 1982. He wrote, "One would expect that adverse human health effects from exposure to PCBs, if they exist, would most readily be identified in groups with the greatest exposures. None of the published occupational or epidemiological studies, including ours, however, have shown that occupational exposure to PCBs is associated with any adverse health outcome." The PCB issue had been raised much earlier when two major false alarms were sounded. The first was in the 1930s, when a chemical mixture containing PCBs, known as Halowax, led to a serious acne-like condition, and in a few cases, deaths due to liver disease. A Harvard scientist studying the incident first reported that PCBs were the most toxic component of the mixture. After studying this further, however, he corrected himself in 1939 by stating that PCBs were almost non-toxic. Unfortunately, his correction got little or no recognition. Almost 40 years later, in 1977, a government report by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health stated that the Halowax experiences have continued to be erroneously cited. Even today, it's not unusual to get a call from a reporter thinking he has discovered some new explosive evidence in these old Halowax incidents discredited by both scientists and the government. Another false alarm, the Yusho incident, was sounded in Japan in 1968. About 1,000 people using a type of vegetable oil from rice hulls in cooking developed severe acne and other symptoms. When PCBs were detected in the oil, the incident became known as the PCB oil disease. However, later analysis by Japanese scientists found that the oil also contained high levels of two other chlorinated chemicals, both high-temperature byproducts of PCBs. They also examined Japanese electrical workers and found that they had higher levels of PCBs in their blood than the Yusho patients. But the workers weren't sick. When scientists dosed monkeys with PCBs and these different chemicals, they concluded that it was these other chemicals and not PCBs that caused the Yusho incident. It was those false alarms that prompted an American researcher, Dr. Renata Kimbrough, to do one of the first rat studies for the U.S. government on PCBs. Dr. Kimbrough found that rats fed large doses of PCBs had increased tumors in their livers. She was heavily involved in this work in the mid-1970s when she was at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and later at the EPA. Just as I had in 1975 with Dr. Selikoff, I wanted a recognized scientist with unassailable integrity and credentials to look at PCBs again. This time, in April 1992, we asked Dr. Kimbrough to take on the assignment. Internally, our PCB efforts were led by Steve Ramsey, former head of the Justice Department's Environmental Enforcement, who now leads GE's Environmental and Safety Operations. He and a GE scientist, Dr. Steve Hamilton, knew critics would still be skeptical of GE-funded research. They established an advisory panel to peer review the Kimbrough and other studies. The panel was made up of U.S. government and academic researchers led by the former head of the National Cancer Institute, Dr. Arthur Upton. Kimbrough studied virtually everyone who ever worked at those two GE plants in Hudson Falls and Fort Edward between 1946 and 1977. Private investigators were hired to track down some of them through payroll records and old telephone directories. Death certificates were examined. Some 7,075 current and former employees were involved in the research. In 1999, Dr. Kimbrough issued a striking report. The death rate due to all types of cancer for employees at our plants was at or significantly below the general and regional population rates. As part of its review of the Kimbrough work before their final decision, the EPA asked an epidemiologist at the University of Southern California's Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center for his opinion. In a letter to the chief of the EPA's Risk Methods Group, Dr. Thomas Mack had this to say. I found the Kimbrough paper to be well-designed, appropriately analyzed, and fairly interpreted. The follow-up was complete. My bottom line